ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When I started interviewing people for this podcast, I was struggling to get them to speak to me about the Prime Minister Narendra Modi. They were worried about the repercussions of saying anything that goes against his carefully crafted story. But I thought I'd be fine as a foreign journalist. I was wrong. Asking the wrong questions about Narendra Modi can land you in hot water. He doesn't like critics, from the media or the opposition. So is the biggest myth of Narendra Modi's story the idea that he leads the largest democracy in the world? I mean, Narendra Modi talks about it all the time.
Democracy is one of our sacred and shared values. It has evolved over a long time and taken various forms of systems. Throughout history, however, one thing has been clear. Democracy is the spirit that supports equality and dignity.
Some polls show Narendra Modi is not just the most popular leader in India, but even in the world. So why is he being accused of silencing critical voices or people who hold him to account? And how will he shape India if he wins another term? I'm Avani Dias and I'm the ABC's South Asia correspondent. I've been learning about Narendra Modi's fascinating and incredibly interesting life, travelling around India to get to the bottom of the myths about this man who is now one of the most powerful people on the globe. On this episode, I want to find out if India is still the largest democracy in the world or if Narendra Modi has killed that title as Prime Minister. It's always weird as a journalist becoming a part of the story, but that's what's happened to me because my story kind of gets interconnected with Modi's. This is Looking for Modi. On this episode, the last one in this series, 1 billion voters.
Kindly be seated. Thank you.
I'm at India's Electoral Commission in New Delhi. Finally, after months of wondering when the country's elections will happen, the dates are being announced. It's going to be the largest electoral vote in history, so I'm excited to hear how this is going to go.
It's a big day today for all of us at ECI, and I would like to formally welcome you to this press conference to announce the schedule for general elections and some state assemblies.
There are hundreds of journalists packed into this auditorium, and the heads of the Electoral Commission, so the body that runs the vote, sit down at a long table on a massive stage. Reporters are everywhere. They're staking out a little bit of space wherever they can to do live crosses as it's all happening. And it's kind of hard for me to hear the actual press conference because there are all these reporters talking to their programs around me. This is the Chief Electoral Commissioner, Rajiv Kumar, as he kicks off his spiel.
I think this is the most awaited press conference in this part of the year. We address you at a precious moment when we as a nation are set to reiterate our pledge to electoral democracy, when Indians will together express their will once again. This is a historic opportunity for all of us.
I'm going to take you through some of the numbers we were told because the sheer size of this election is so mind-boggling. There are almost 1 billion registered voters in India. There are 15 million electoral staff. They travel across deserts in northern India, glaciers in the Himalayas, jungles and oceans to make sure everyone can vote. Because this country is so huge, the vote doesn't happen on one day like in other nations. It happens over 6 weeks. And the election commissioner keeps reiterating something, just how big of a democracy India is.
Let me say in the very beginning that it is our promise to deliver a national election in a manner that we add to our global shine and remain a beacon for electoral democracies across the world. We are committed to give the nation a truly festive democratic environment, and we will take democracy every corner of the country.
despite this being a year of elections across the world, I think over 70 countries going to the polls, the spotlight will to very much be on India as the world's largest democracy, and this is going to be the world's largest electoral exercise.
This is Dr. Chidich Bajpai. He's a political analyst and has researched India, and he's now at Chatham House in the UK. A major part of being a democratic country is having free and fair elections. And Chidich told me, yeah, India definitely has a pretty amazing version of that. It's clear to me as well that this vote is super impressive.
At least at a procedural level, I think, yes, democracy does remain intact. And I think India, and not just the Modi government, but Indian governments have always, I think, looked to India's status as the world's largest democracy, and also the fact that it is a developing and emerging economy is a sign of its status on the world stage.
The Modi government uses its title as the world's largest democracy to get close to other Western nations like Australia, the UK, and the US. Modi's like, we're all one big democratic family. And India uses it to get more of a status on the globe, like to get a spot in the exclusive club of nations that's meant to make sure there's peace and security in the world.
I think it's one of the credentials that it uses to try and call for India to have an expanded role on the world stage, including, for instance, having a permanent seat on the UN Security Council.
India also has electronic voting, so these machines are transported across the country, and the Electoral Commission says they're foolproof and have never been hacked. That's a big deal for South Asia. There are constant allegations of voter fraud and rigging in other countries in this area, but the Commission says that doesn't happen in India. These electoral staff say they get a voting machine to anyone who wants one. Even, for example, this random guy who lives alone in this village you can only reach by foot. Chidich says this digital system has made things more democratic.
Over the last decade or so, it has arguably become better governed. And one area which comes to mind is the issue of digital public infrastructure, which India has really promoted. We saw this during its G20 presidency. And it's seen as a means to improve digital inclusion, facilitate the democratization of technology, helping to streamline welfare payments, reducing space for corruption, direct benefit transfers.
All the predictions say Narendra Modi will win this election comfortably. Polls have been wrong before, but being on the ground here, it just seems really unlikely anyone else will win. And it is impressive that in a democracy like this, Modi's likely to win a rare third consecutive term after winning the last election in a landslide. The only other prime minister to do that was India's first leader, Jawaharlal Nehru, who fought for independence from the British. So he was in a strong position from his first term.
Well, I would argue that a third term Modi-led BJP government appears to be a foregone conclusion. I mean, I think Modi is arguably in a stronger position going into this year's election than he was even in the previous election in 2019. The economy is in better shape. You know, India is projected to be the world's fastest growing major economy this year. Modi's approval ratings are the highest among several world leaders. So I think it's in a very strong position to get reelected.
One massive thing that's working in Modi's favour is that there isn't much of an opposition. With such a huge population, there are heaps of opposition parties, but this election, more than two dozen of them decided to come together for the first time.
With all 26 parties, a new name is given, that is Indian National Developmental Inclusive Alliance.
In July 2023, the parties formed the India Alliance. Usually they disagree on a lot of things. They have different policies and ideas about how to govern the country. The only thing binding them together right now, though, they think Narendra Modi is ruining India and he needs to be defeated.
Ladai BJP ki vichardhara.
Rahul Gandhi, one of the opposition leaders, said, "Our fight is against BJP's ideology. Unemployment is rising and the country's entire wealth is in the hands of a few people. The country's voice is being suppressed. So our fight is for the country's voice. Therefore, we choose this name, Indian National Developmental Inclusive Alliance, which means India."
Or India ke beech mein.
It seemed like finally there was going to be some sort of challenge to Modi. But in the months since the alliance was formed, it's kind of lost steam. There's infighting and the parties can't agree on how to share seats or policies.
I think there were some hopes last year when this opposition India alliance was formed. But frankly, you know, I think if you look at the numbers and look at the analysis, I mean, it's the opposition has really failed to successfully challenge the BJP on some of its policy failures. And I think there's a lack of a credible narrative and also, I think, a prominent personality to counter Modi.
Yeah, Cherdich says the story Modi has been selling, the one we've been dissecting throughout this podcast, is just too hard to beat.
And I think Modi's strength really rests on four key pillars. The welfare and development-driven agenda pursued by the BJP, the Hindutva card or the Hindu nationalist card, hyper-nationalism, and then the Modi brand. And what we see is that no party or politician has really been able to replicate this.
So it's all been looking like Modi's got a sweet, easy path to another election victory. Then it came out a leader of a key opposition party in the alliance had been arrested. I've come to a protest in the middle of Delhi. People here are trying to get to Narendra Modi's party office. It's a huge brown building. There are clearly a lot of staff working for the BJP, and Modi's face is, of course, on big billboards out the front. But these protesters aren't even getting close to the building. There are dozens of police along the streets. Some are in riot gear, holding batons and shields. This protest is happening because the Chief Minister of Delhi, Arvind Kejriwal, who is also the head of one of the key opposition parties, ARP, was arrested.
Our leader, Arvind Kejriwal, ko foran riha kiya jaye.
Reena Gupta, a party advisor for the ARP party, says our leader Arvind Kejriwal should be released immediately. His arrest was illegal. Modi is scared of Arvind campaigning for the upcoming general elections. They have arrested Kejriwal to prevent him from campaigning. Kejriwal was accused of corruption for banking a billion or so rupees from kickbacks from a new alcohol licensing policy in his state. This is a spokesman from Modi's party, the BJP.
Arvind Kejriwal ek bad idea. The idea of corruption, the idea of minting money through through an excise policy. I mean, this is unheard of.
Kejriwal's arrest was dramatic. Police arrived late at night to his home in Delhi. People started protesting.
I think Kejriwal was one of the few figures that had really broad public support in pockets of the country. At the most fundamental level, it's the government trying to discredit the opposition in some shape or form. Looking closely at some transactions that appear to be problematic. But if you look at the data, 90% plus of these probes are aimed at opposition figures rather than BJP figures. And, you know, that's not a coincidence.
That's Associate Professor Maya Tudor, and she's researching democracy in South Asia at Oxford. Here's the thing. The authority that arrested Kejriwal, the Enforcement Directorate, is an agency that comes under the Modi government. And while all of this was going on, the biggest opposition party, Congress, has said its bank accounts have been frozen, accused of tax fraud. So paying for campaigning at this crucial time has become a challenge. The BJP says, well, we're just following the law. It's not our fault the opposition parties are the ones doing the wrong thing. But Maya says it's weird that Modi's party barely gets targeted by the Indian authorities.
9 in 10 cases are being lodged against opposition politicians. And ones that are relatively high profile, then one wonders, is that actually reflecting an underlying implementation of the rule of law, or is it reflecting an underlying selective use of the arms of the state to investigate and to intimidate politicians or bureaucrats or any shape of would-be dissenters into silencing their dissent against the government?
And you know how we've been talking about India getting closer to Western countries by being like, we're all democracies? Well, a spokesman from Germany's Foreign Office said Kejriwal is entitled to a fair trial.
Indien ist ein demokratisch verfasstes Land.
He says, we assume and expect that the standards relating to independence of judiciary and basic democratic principles will also be applied in this case. And a spokesperson for the US State Department made a similar comment. Modi's government hit back at both countries and they said, stay out of our business.
The recent remarks by the State Department are unwarranted. Any such external imputation on our electoral and legal processes is completely unacceptable. In India, legal processes are driven only by the rule of law. Anyone who has similar ethos, especially fellow democracies, should have no difficulty in appreciating this fact.
Yeah, pretty touchy response towards the US government, one which has supposedly been getting close to India. Maya Tudor from Oxford University says when the Modi government gets criticised by anyone foreign, it goes, well, you're just jealous of how great our country is doing. You have a bias against India, so there's no accountability.
What has happened in the last decade is that nationalism has been told through the prism of foreign governments trying to hold India back because they are jealous of India's high growth rates, and it's a time of India shining. And foreign governments that are jealous are trying to hold India back.
And when anyone in India criticizes Modi, his party just says they're being like the foreigners.
So there's a linking of what domestic opposition is doing to kind of foreign agents that are trying to hold India back in some way. And that's a very old tactic that, you know, many governments, democratic and non-democratic alike, have tried to use. And that's an effort to delegitimate what the opposition is saying. So people might say, why are you reading foreign media? They are trying to hold India back. So they are criticizing India. And that, again, is a way in which dissent is delegitimized.
A major part of being a democratic country means people have civil liberties, like freedom of religion, that there's equality and protection of minorities, all things Modi has been accused of targeting to get ultimate power.
I think there is very little question in anyone's mind that the Modi government is stifling dissent. It is doing so through a variety of channels. One channel is the inability of the opposition to broadly criticize without being labeled a kind of front for minorities. I think the Congress Party launched its platform for the upcoming elections that Modi says it bears the imprint of Muslims. And so there's a broad attempt to discredit criticism as kind of minority pandering. That's absolutely happening.
Political analyst Chidich Bajpai says the Modi government is using its bureaucracy and government agencies to target dissent. It's kind of subtle.
So I think there are some genuine concerns that the government is pursuing authoritarianism by stealth, by controlling, you know, key levers of power, the judiciary, the media, security services. We've seen this with, for instance, tax raids on several NGOs and media organizations. So I think, you know, there's also this push towards a, you know, growing centralization of power. And yeah, a witch hunt of sorts against opposition politicians and parties.
He is also optimistic that the systems in India are stronger than one man, Modi.
I think the claims about India sliding into a dictatorship, I think that they are somewhat exaggerated. I think the institutions are still stronger than the individual.
But many organizations have genuine concerns about the direction the country is headed in. Reporters Without Borders has warned press freedom is in crisis in India, another key part of a democracy. In its most recent report, it found an average of 3 or 4 journalists are killed in connection with their work in the country every year.
What that means in practical terms is that most mainstream news media is simply uncritical of Modi, and that's the best that can be said. In some cases, they're really openly open cheerleaders. And again, it isn't the case that that isn't sometimes warranted in democratic governments, that you give credit where credit is due. But there's a very important role for people to be thinking critically about what has their government actually achieved while in office. There's one more thing I want to mention in this, and you know, it's important because I'm speaking to foreign media in the sense that this is an Australian podcast, and foreign media is also being delegitimated. And this is a really subtle, but I think very important point.
And that's a problem I've been struggling with firsthand.
These protesters want answers. We're taking you to the heartland of this movement considered so dangerous by the Indian government. It's now at the centre of an international murder conspiracy.
So while I've been recording this podcast, I've been investigating allegations that the Narendra Modi government is assassinating overseas dissidents. I made a program about it for the ABC's show Foreign Correspondent.
Reaction is pouring in tonight to that breaking news. The Prime Minister accusing India of orchestrating the killing of a Canadian citizen here in this country.
Sikh separatists all over the world have been calling for Punjab in northern India to split from the country and become an independent nation. Last year, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made the accusation that the Modi government assassinated a Sikh separatist in Vancouver. According to him, it's just another example of threats to democracy in India.
Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. It is contrary to the fundamental rules by which free, open and democratic societies conduct themselves. As you would expect, we've been working closely and coordinating with our allies on this very serious matter.
During the shoot, we kept getting questioned by Indian authorities. We were even stopped by them from shooting a public event. We showed that in the piece. Less than a week after we put the story up, the Indian government blocked our story on YouTube and other social media sites in India. Now, when you try to watch it on YouTube in India, it says, "This content is currently unavailable in this country because of an order from the government related to national security or public order." I expected the Indian government to block the piece, to be honest. A story on the same topic by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation was taken down a few weeks before. And remember, a few episodes ago, we spoke about the BBC piece about Modi's role in the Gujarat riots that was banned as well. Maya Tudor says these are more examples of the Modi government using enforcement agencies and the law to silence dissent and accountability.
I'm deeply worried about the future of media in India. It's the single thing I'm most worried about because media creates the virtual public square in which citizens can come together and discuss and debate. And the large networks in India are virtually all controlled by businessmen that are very close to Narendra Modi. And there's virtually been a shutdown of genuinely critical and independent voices.
So I thought that was the end of it and that it was time to get into other stories, but I was still waiting on my annual visa renewal. I thought the process was just slow. I was also running out of time though. I had just a couple of weeks left until my current visa expired and was beginning to worry about why it was becoming delayed and what I'd do if it didn't turn up. Then I got a call from someone from the Indian Ministry saying my routine visa extension application wasn't going to come through and that I have to leave the country in just a couple of weeks. He specifically said it was because of my Sikh separatist story, saying it had gone too far, and he even referenced this podcast. It felt really shocking. This place my partner and I had called home for the last 2.5 years, this place we had loved so much, was not going to be home anymore. And we were being forced to leave on the Indian government's terms. We weren't sure if we'd ever get to go back to India and we really needed some packing boxes. After a couple of weeks of limbo and lobbying from the Australian government, the Modi administration gave me the visa in the very last minute. But it felt too difficult to do my job in India. I was struggling to get into public events run by Modi's party. The government wouldn't even give me the passes I need to cover the election. And the ministry left it all so late that we were already packed up and ready to go. It's all by design. The Narendra Modi government has made me feel so uncomfortable that we decided to leave. There's always a feeling of unease that this sort of backlash could come your way as a journalist in India. I've felt it the whole time I've been here. So have my colleagues from different publications. And now, more than ever, I understand why so many people were not keen to speak to me about Narendra Modi. When I arrived in India, I knew the country had issues, but I never imagined I'd struggle to get a routine visa. In my 2.5 years, I've seen India change. Someone once described it as like being at the bottom of a lift going up, because this country has elevated its status under Narendra Modi. As China's power continues to grow, lots of Western countries want a friend in the region. India is definitely more democratic than Beijing, and that means the West is willing to overlook some things. And some point out there are problems with democracy in countries like Australia, the US, and the UK. Nowhere is perfect. But while Modi says this country is the mother of democracy, the reality on the ground feels different. Maya Tudor says while India's holding the biggest vote in history, that doesn't necessarily mean it's still a democracy.
And I know that many people say it is the world's largest democracy, but as many of the watchdogs that are independent have said, you know, India is not functionally a full democracy anymore. It's in this hybrid area. The heart of a democracy. So when your listeners are thinking about what the word democracy means to them, you know, your everyday voter understands that what democracy is fundamentally about is the accountability of a government for its performance. I am concerned for the future of India. I mean, India is a country full of an incredible amount of talent and aspiration and innovation. And that will continue under, I think, any government. But the ability to think critically about what your government is doing and whether that is actually serving your interests, insofar as that ability disappears from Indian political life, I think there's very serious grounds for concern.
We tried many times to get an interview with Narendra Modi, and his government doesn't respond to written questions. But in other interviews with Indian publications, he has constantly denied he is threatening democracy. I started this series looking for Narendra Modi, and I found a man whose need to control his story has nearly destroyed his career a few times. I've also been in a room with Modi speaking to a crowd so much now, and it genuinely feels like you're at this music festival with the biggest artist in the world playing. People are obsessed, and the way he captures a room when he tells his story is really powerful. It's hard not to get caught up in it. The stature Modi's built for himself and India on the world stage has been impressive to watch. Many Indians genuinely feel that Modi has improved their country and their lives. He might just achieve his goal of making this country a developed one and a superpower, but at what cost? There are a lot of people who no longer feel safe in Narendra Modi's India. They feel targeted and like they don't have a future here. Many of them are too scared to speak up or challenge Modi's story because they know there will be backlash. Modi's entire life has centered around being India's leader. Many say he'll do anything to hold on to that. The BJP has an age limit of 75 years for electoral candidates, meaning Modi can't run after this election. Rules can change, though. And something his childhood friend Shyamal Das Modi said stuck with me. He will not leave the post of Prime Minister while he's alive, he said. He is such a powerful person. This podcast is by me, Avani Dias, and produced by Madeline Jenner. Research by Som Patida. Audio production is by Anna John. This is the last episode in this series, but there will be more coverage across the ABC on the Indian election in the weeks ahead, and I'll be back in this feed after the election in June to discuss the results. Thanks so much for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.